versus David J. Hibbler Jr. Mr. Wilson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
You may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel of the state. My name is Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter, David Hibbler Jr. Mr. Hibbler deals from his conviction for the offense of first-degree sexual assault of a child, incest, third-degree sexual assault of a child. In this case, we've raised seven assignments of error, among which this court granted bypass to address the constitutionality of Nebraska Revised Statute Section 28-319.01. We've raised constitutionality of that statute on its face, and in doing so, we've asked the court to evaluate whether the cutoffs in this statute, their age cutoffs, we're asking the court to evaluate whether those cutoffs are unconstitutionally arbitrary in nature. I think I might start, however, if the court would indulge me, there's assignment of error two that actually goes to some diary entries that were reportedly authored by my client. And what I'd like the court to consider here is the rule that there was an exception that these were allowed, the exception allowing the introduction of these based on an express or implied argument that the declarant was fabricating testimony. Now, what I'd like the court to consider and what we feel is most important here is that at the time that these were offered, what the only real express or implied charges of fabrication were being leveled at A.H., who's J.H.'s mother. And so there weren't really any express or implied charges of fabrication made directly against J.H. In fact, if you compare the cross-examination, the steps that trial counsel took with respect to J.H., he was pretty careful in not doing so. In fact, what he did was he asked the sort of questions that would really go to credibility. And there is a difference, Your Honors. If you look at Buechler, that's the case that we've cited. There's a clear difference between questioning the credibility of a witness as opposed to implying or expressly alleging fabrication. And for those reasons, we'd argue that the exception...
If there's a clear difference, what is it?
Well, Buechler does a good job of explaining that, Your Honor. It does suggest that when you're simply getting at the circumstances of the prior statements, or you're getting at the circumstances of the substance of the testimony, really, whether, you know, the person could remember, whether the circumstances under which the memories were formed, the distance and, you know, the amount of time that's passed, the potential for misremembering, the potential, you know, the prior inconsistent statements. And that is what trial counsel in this case did question J.H. about, were prior inconsistent statements given during interviews. That was seen in Buechler as questioning credibility, specifically. And really the only difference between, I'd argue, between that sort of impeachment and this impeachment is that, you know, this court ended up allowing those statements, or excuse me, affirming the trial court's decision to exclude the prior consistent statements that were offered by the defendant in that case. Here, we have prior consistent statements being offered by the state, and the trial court, under what I'd argue are very similar circumstances, allowed the prior consistent statement.
Does the evidentiary ruling in the context of the trial matter or can be assessed by comparison of the theory of the defense? So if the theory of the defense was largely that the mother fabricated stuff and encouraged the victim to fabricate stuff, is that relevant to the ruling made in the context of this trial?
Yes, Your Honor, it's relevant. I think, given that the allegations, there was evidence offered here. Let's get to the evidence. That helps us in the context of the trial. There was evidence offered here that they watched a movie together, and that during this movie there was one of the characters was subject to abuse and had a hard time disclosing it.
Right, and the theory of the defense is in part, this serves as the gateway, right, for mom to start imbuing memories or something to that effect.
Yes, and that's, yes, Your Honor. And that's where we go to, you know, again, when you're talking to a child who's a victim of sexual assault and you're asking her questions about what happened in the lead up to the disclosure, you're not necessarily expressly or implying that she's fabricating if you're getting to the circumstances surrounding that disclosure. If there was an adult who perhaps said some things that might have planted a memory, for instance, that's the sort of thing that we'd argue shouldn't open the door under the exception to hearsay to the prior consistent statements.
But if she said something before watching the movie, wouldn't that have some relevance?
Relevance is a different question. Your Honor, yes, it has relevance, but I
wouldn't it go to contest the recent fabrication or the influence created by the mother in watching the movie? Wouldn't it have some bearing on that as well?
Your Honor, yes, it could. I do believe that if it has bearing on that, though, or I shouldn't say I believe, but it, you know, looking at the law that I've looked at here in Buechler, you know, there are different ways of impeaching credibility. And what we're arguing here is that the impeachment of J.H.'s credibility did not, it was specific to her, and it was not necessarily, it did not open the door for the entry of the prior consistent statements.
What was the impeachment of her credibility?
Well, the impeachment of her credibility, I think, as I was saying earlier, seemed to, you know, was focused on the prior inconsistent statements and the conversations that she had with her mother. Good question. I do want to consider that some more, so I think I'll save the rest of my time.
Before your time runs out,
yes.
In your constitutional arguments, are you claiming that there is no reasonable line at which the legislature could draw age distinctions?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe
so. What is it about these particular lines that is somehow beyond the ability of a legislature to make reasonable decisions?
These particular lines are arbitrary just by pure virtue of the fact that there's nothing indicating the rational basis for picking the cutoff of 12 years. The victim in this case, I think was, if I'm not mistaken, 11 years old at the time of the offense.
What would be a non-arbitrary age demarcation? Aren't all age cutoffs arbitrary in some sense?
No, I think that there probably, there can be age cutoffs in statutes like these. We do see them across the country, but what we don't see necessarily are these windows that are ranges between 25, for instance, as a cutoff. I couldn't find another statute anywhere in our country that just, again, that we saw as being arbitrary. And ultimately, we've raised it as a facial challenge. And if anything on the face of the statute is unconstitutionally arbitrary, whether it be the 12-year cutoff or the 25-year cutoff, we'd argue it's unconstitutional as applied in all contexts to all defendants. I think that is certainly, you know, discussed in my brief, but I don't want to go.
But under what constitutional theory? Is this an equal protection argument, a due process argument, a cruel and unusual? Help us out.
Yes, that's
which
and I listed them in the brief. They're all there, Your Honor. Yes, and that's a fair question, Your Honor. It ultimately equal protection is certainly, I think, at the top of the list, because you know you're dividing our population into two subsets, the potential defendants into two subsets, those that are under 25, those that are over 25.
Haven't we all read a lot about brain development of juveniles that speaks to age 25 approximately?
If we have, Your Honor, it's not in anything in the legislative history that I saw.
So the legislature has to express something in their history before the line that they draw will be considered rational?
No, Your Honor, you're right. They don't necessarily have to. And this court's bound to uphold their statutes, you know, if there's a rational basis for them. I don't think we can look at the legislative history of this particular statute, though, and find such a rational basis for instance, the 25-year cutoff. I'd argue the same for the 12-year cutoff, but really, in particular to the 25-year cutoff, we can't find one. So, you know, I looked at case law, I looked at other states, I looked everywhere, particularly that age 25 cutoff. I couldn't find a corollary anywhere else. I couldn't find case law really explaining why 25 should be the cutoff for this particular.
Well, let's take the under 12 feature.
Okay.
And it customarily in an equal protection assessment, we got to find somebody similarly situated and then commence a comparison, right? Are you aware of any other statute where we have a victim under 12?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
That's the one on deck.
Right. Yes, the one that we're considering here, mm-hmm. the one I've raised as an issue in this case, uses 12 as the cutoff.
That's important to this charge.
To this charge, yes.
And these facts.
Yes, Your Honor, as applied in this case, it is very important.
Right.
Had I raised this as an as-applied constitutional challenge, you know, I think I'd have a bit of a problem there with the fact that this alleged victim's 11 years old. But I'm raising it as unconstitutional on its face.
No application where the victim is under 12 could be constitutional.
When you have an unconstitutional statute, my understanding of the case law is that when you have an unconstitutional statute that's unconstitutional on its face, it's unconstitutional as applied to anyone in all contexts. That's my understanding of the case law. Your Honor can obviously correct me if I'm wrong. I do believe that if that either of those are cutoffs are unconstitutionally arbitrary, whether it be the 12-year cutoff or the 25-year cutoff, either, you know, for the victim or for the defendant.
Well, I find you reluctant to address the 12 and under only. You're doing this in combination when you got a 12 and a 19 or a 19 and or a 25. Then you find your facial challenge stronger.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Would my facial challenge be stronger depending on whether I'm challenging either cutoff?
For the perpetrator, not the victim.
No, Your Honor, and the reason I say that again, I come back to the case law that suggests that as long as the statute's unconstitutional on its face, I can make an argument that it's unconstitutional as applied to all defendants in all contexts. That's the basis for me challenging the statute. If I'd made an as-applied constitutional, argued it as applied in this case, it was unconstitutional. Yes, I'd have a hard time arguing that the mandatory minimum shouldn't apply when the victim was under 12. I don't know if that answers the court's question.
That's helpful. Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Appellant has assigned numerous errors, all of which the state believes are without merit, or in the case of many of appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claims, unable to be addressed on the record before this court on direct appeal. We ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Pending specific questions from this court, I will begin where you left off with appellant, with a constitutional challenge. Appellant argues the age classifications provided in the first-degree sexual assault of a child statute are unconstitutional and that they do not have a rational basis in law or fact. The state disagrees. Initially, I will point out, as the state did in brief, that appellant's motion to quash alleges only that subsection 2 of the statute is unconstitutional, and that is the provision of the statute that applies a 15-year mandatory minimum penalty to those convicted under the statute. The age classifications, which appellant focuses his argument on appeal, were created and put into place in the statute in subsections 1A and 1B. But to the extent that this court does believe that appellant has preserved his challenge to the entire statute, I will go on to address those classifications. Because the classifications here are based upon age, they are subject to a rational basis review. So long as there is a plausible policy reason for the classification, the facts on which the classification are based may rationally have been considered true by the governmental decision maker, and the relationship between the classification and the goal is not so attenuated as to render the distinction arbitrary or unconstitutional, the classifications will stand. Here, the legislature may have considered the lasting harm done to children who are victims of sexual abuse, that an adult should be aware of the harm that is caused to a child by sexual abuse, and that that adult should be punished more harshly for his or her conduct of preying on children. In order to protect young children and deter those adults who would prey upon them, the legislature instituted harsher penalties for those who offend against children, and in particular, adults whose victims are significantly younger than the defendant. Appellant has failed to show that there is no rational policy basis, that the facts on which classification have been based may not have rationally been considered to be true, or that the relationship between the classifications and the goal are so attenuated as to render this distinction arbitrary and unconstitutional, and his facial challenge to the statute fails.
What's the policy difference for treating a victim differently because he or she is age 11 as opposed to age 13?
Your Honor, I think that, as kind of mentioned earlier, that at some point the legislature draws lines. And close to border lines, this court has recognized that sometimes when you're close to that age line, it may seem, in certain situations, to be unfair, or if someone was just a little older or a little younger.
Well, let's. Okay. What about the difference between age 6 and age 14? What is it about much younger victims that justifies the distinction?
Your Honor, I think, again, go back to that the harm that is caused, and not that there's not harm caused to victims of any age, but I think the legislature in the legislative history of the changes made to the statute, so it was originally over 19 and victim under 12, and then a few years later, a provision was added in that put in that over 25, between 12 and 16. One of the statements made during in 2009, when the over 25 and between 12 and 16 was put in place, by one of the senators in the Judiciary Committee hearing, stated that one of the provisions in the bill was that the senator, I'm quoting, says, "It takes care of one of the problems that often has given me pause in this area, which is older, usually boys, but sometimes girls dating younger members in their high school, introduces a concept of ages to get away from a sliding scale. Basically, a person who's over 25 has no business dating younger people, and it sets that forth in the bill. So I think the legislature recognized that perhaps, you know, as you get up into 14 and 15, maybe there are going to be individuals in high school dating, and there might be, and I recognize that pulls in the age of the offender, which you, and you asked about the age of the victim, but I think it all kind of flows together in the statute. So that the older the victim gets, you know, 14, 15, you might have a dating relationship between two high school students. And I think in earlier Judiciary Committee hearings in 2006, when the bill was first introduced, as well as on the floor, that senators expressed that particularly offenders who offend against young children should be punished and taken away from the community, and that there's great harm done to victims of sexual abuse as children.
Would that age distinction be rely upon the vulnerability of the victim?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's also a very good point, that a six-year-old is different than a 15-year-old. They're both still vulnerable victims, but a six-year-old is, you know, much more vulnerable than, you know, or a four-year-old who's maybe not in school and not around other adults to seek help or have access to that, whereas a 14 or 15-year-old may be in a different position in that regard. I will turn now to appellant's argument regarding the diary entries, Exhibit 24. Appellant argues the district court erred in admitting Exhibit 24, but the diary entries were allowed into evidence to rebut claims of fabrication or improper influence or motive. While appellant argues that he only attempted to impeach the victim's credibility and that he did not make an express or implied charge of fabrication or improper influence or motive, the state disagrees. During opening statements, trial counsel made statements that implied that the mother of the victim was sneaky, that she showed a movie about abuse, and that the jury would have to decide if the victim was using the story her mother put in the victim's head, and that the victim then told the story to her friends to get attention. During his cross-examination of the victim, the appellant questioned the victim's timeline of events, including when she watched this movie with her mother and when she disclosed to her friends. The victim testified these diary entries were written during the time the abuse was occurring, so October 2015 to before she disclosed to her friends in February, or I'm sorry, October 2015, the disclosure to her friends occurred in February 2016, and both the victim and the mother testified that the movie watching occurred in March of 2016. In these diary entries, the victim writes that she is, she has a deep, dark secret, that she's being, I believe, touched by her father, that she writes statements consistent with this abuse that occurred before the incident of watching the movie with her mother, that appellant argued at trial was the impetus for this story getting placed in her head. So these diary entries show that prior to this incident with her mother, she was writing story, she was writing in her diary that this abuse was occurring. So it rebutted that charge of fabrication or improper influence or motive. Appellant has assigned several other errors on appeal. The state believes that those are all adequately addressed in our brief. Unless this court has specific questions on those other assignments of error, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on.